Thank you. Generally, a chaste woman becomes a very obedient wife. This causes a husband to become attached to his wife, and consequently, he thinks of his wife very much at the time of death. This is a very dangerous situation, as is evident from the life of King Kamuna. If one thinks of his wife as a Christian, at the time of death, he will certainly not return to the time of death. But will be forced to accept the body of a woman, and thus begin another chapter of material existence. Shiva Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Om Agyam Tumana Shara.
Generally, whatever one is doing throughout one's life, that will determine the type of thoughts one will be having at the time of death. That's what Srila Prabhupada comments in the purport on this verse. So whatever one is doing very strongly, not ritualistically, but genuinely throughout his life, then that will influence his thoughts at the time of death. So sometimes we may be thinking, that because I am ritualistically performing the activities of Krishna consciousness, then naturally I'll be able to think of Krishna. But if the activity is a ritual, rituals are not as powerful as something that you're doing from the heart, spontaneously. So generally, religious practices do become something like dry rituals for most persons. And when it comes to family maintenance, it's from the heart. Because of selfishness, actually. It is done with a heart because of the selfish predilection of the conditioned soul. As we've described before in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami is commenting, is replying to the question of Parikshit Maharaj, that why is it that the cowherd men and women and cows, etc., exhibited more affection for Krishna when the cowherd boys, etc., were expansions of Krishna? When they were their actual sons, they didn't exhibit as much affection as in the case when it was an expansion of Krishna direct. They exhibited more affection. So then Shukadeva Goswami wants to come to the point how Krishna is the soul of the soul, or the life of all the living entities. And therefore it is very natural for the living entity to love Krishna. I'm not going to go through that whole philosophical delineation. Maybe if someone wants to know at the end, I can explain it. But in the beginning of that meditation, Shukadeva Goswami explains that it is certainly the self that is more dear, that is most dear. And the dearness of other things are due to the dearness of the self. So that seems to be a little bit counterintuitive, because you see like a mother sacrificing all energy for a child. So then you think, like we were hearing yesterday, that's the closest thing we get to selflessness in the material world, and that's completely selfish. And the closest thing we get to selflessness, and it's also completely selfish, because as it is described, if she didn't have the egotism of being a mother, would she make the same sacrifice for the child? She's sacrificing for her child. Why she's not sacrificing for the other children with the same enthusiasm? Because the sacrifice for her child gratifies that egotism that I'm the mother of this living entity. So therefore, that sacrificing all energy, giving up one's, you know, sometimes a parent may give up, sacrifice various jobs even or positions, but it's gratifying that ego that I'm a mother or I'm a parent of this person. So it's completely actually selfish to be, if we want to be honest with ourselves, it's selfish. So this family maintenance is usually done from the heart or genuinely because of the selfish predilection of the conditioned soul. Whereas because we don't identify with Krishna, we don't say Krishna is mine. Most of us don't think Krishna is mine. Therefore, it doesn't have that profound of an impact on the consciousness. When, as the saying goes, possession turns sand into gold. So when one is thinking something is mine, then it reinforces a particular conception of the self, and it is very powerful and inspiring genuineness in the living entity in the activities towards the thing he's thinking is his. So when you think this is my computer, for example, then you very genuinely take care of the computer. And if someone wants to, can I use your computer? You know, can I use your computer, Prabhu? Or my, you know, well, if you're going to use it, you'll give them a whole list of, you know, rules and regulations, yamas and niyamas, in the application of the usage of the computer, because you think it's mine. Whereas if someone else's computer is like, can I use this? Yeah, sure. Yeah, because it's not yours, you don't even care to, yeah, sure, go ahead. I don't think the devotee would mind, like that. So therefore, if the point being discussed is that if Krishna consciousness is just a ritual, even if we are doing it throughout our life, but genuinely doing something which is reinforcing our bodily conception, then naturally at the time of death, we're going to think of something of the bodily concept of life, and we're going to get another material body. So that's what's happening to Paranjana, and that's what happens to the living entity genuinely. If he's not able to chant, worship, you know, etc., the activities of Krishna consciousness from the heart, then he can hardly expect that he'll be able to think of Krishna at the time of death. Naturally, whatever he's genuinely attached to, that he will genuinely think of at the time of death. It's a question of genuineness. And how genuine are we in our chanting, in our hearing, in our worship, in our association of the with the devotees? It's a question of how genuine we are. That will actually determine the influence on the consciousness at the time of death. So here, so Arjuna asks the question, how can one remember you at the time of death? He poses this question to Krishna at the beginning of chapter 8. So Krishna told him, why only at the time of death? Tasma sarveshu kaleshu mamanusmana yudhacha. Not only at the time of death you should think of me, but sarva kaleshu, at all times you should be thinking of me, genuinely. Mamanusmana. And if Arjuna says, oh, I like that program, I'll go to the forest and think of you, as you suggested. Then Krishna said, yudhacha, and you also fight. Don't forget your particular duties that you have to render. You think of me, and at the same time you execute your duty. Maya sakta mano buddhir, with mind and intelligence fixed on me. And in this way, you'll come to me, asamshayam, without any doubt. You should not have any doubt about this. Because if we have doubt about this, doubt about our coming to Krishna, then that doubt will weaken resolve. Means determination takes place proportionate the degree of freedom from doubts. When there are doubts, then one cannot be so determined in his attempt to attain Krishna, to attain the spiritual world, because the doubts won't allow him to be so determined. Just like even if we believe, accept, have faith that the spiritual reality is there, a prominent doubt amongst devotees who are neophyte is that we don't have faith if we can attain that. Because it just seems very far out, you know, that you can attain Krishna. So Krishna's, Prabhupada was saying in one lecture, our process is to teach you how to dance with Krishna, how to dance with God. That's like far out. One may be having doubt. How will I dance with God? I'm just a tiny, insignificant jiva. How is that possible? In fact, the Christians, they have a whole philosophy that if you see God, you'll die immediately. We were at the Cook County Hospital one time. We were just like this. Mariah Chaitanya was taking us there for insurance or whatever. And one Christian lady was asking me about our philosophy. So I was saying how to see God and all these things like that. And I said, don't you want to see God? She said, no. Just like that, like with her face got all contorted. She said, no. And I was like, why not? She said, because as soon as you see God, you'll die. Anyway, you're going to die, so might as well see God. Since death is anyway coming. So this is a whole, they don't have faith that you can see God. What to speak of dance with the Lord? If you're thinking that by seeing him I will die, then what to speak of dancing with Krishna? So anyway, unless we have that faith, we won't be able to be determined in our attempts to attain Krishna. So Krishna is saying we should be free from these doubts by the process of hearing from him and his representatives. Be free from these doubts so that the real pure devotional faith can be engendered and we can charge full speed ahead toward attaining the lotus feet of Krishna. But it has to be a genuine practice, sarveshu kaleshu, all the time. So then the doubt comes, how does one engage in their practical duties and at the same time give their heart to Krishna? When Lord Chaitanya received a letter from Rupa and Sanatana Goswami about they're trying to leave their work and join Lord Chaitanya's movement, Lord Chaitanya wrote them back, and he was the one who gave this analogy of a woman who is keeping a paramour. This is a woman who is keeping a paramour. She very carefully carries out her duties so the husband shall not suspect anything. But in our heart of hearts, she is thinking of her paramour. So in the same way he was instructing Rupa and Sanatana, in the same way you should perform your work, that you are very carefully carrying out your duties in this context so that no one will suspect your devotion to Krishna. But your heart is completely sold out to Krishna. And of course to himself, he's also Krishna. And in that way you'll attain me. So Srila Prabhupada speaks about this in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita. It is a question of genuineness, or the word that is used is genuine attraction, or raga. Everyone's got attraction. But how genuine is our attraction for Krishna? Param jistva navartite. Well, according to the genuineness of the attraction, then to that degree, we will actually be able to think of Krishna at the time of death, because we'll be attached to Krishna. Otherwise, the material attraction does not allow us to be genuine. In order to become more and more sincere, we have to perform sadhana bhakti, and we have to examine how much are we actually getting attraction for Krishna. It'd be somewhat easy to determine by the things that we find very tasty in Krishna consciousness. Usually in the beginning stages, gossip is very tasty, dandavat is very tasty. I mean, dandavat is supposed to be a good one, but even dandavat and internet, endless amounts of time on the internet. Prasadam, that depends. If it's lasagna, very tasty. If it's khichdi, if it's burfis, very tasty. If it's something bitter melon, not so much. So anyway, what is our attraction? We have to always be examining where is our attraction in Krishna consciousness. When we first come to the Krishna consciousness movement, our attraction is usually based on various material conceptions. Usually, maybe if the devotees were nice to me, they always glorified me. That was very attractive in the beginning. No one glorifies you so much in the material world. And devotees, because generally, especially in neophyte devotees, they always speak big, big words. And when the new persons come who are more neophyte, they hear those big, big words and they think, wow, these people are so wonderful. And in that way, they become inspired to join up. And after they join up, then the devotee takes off that face. And maybe his genuine face is there where he doesn't even say Hari Bol to you in the bathroom or something. And you feel fried out. What happened to all the glorification? Now you're yelling at me and all these things like that. So then you want to leave. Or you come, as Krishna describes, four types of persons who come to him. Chaturvidabha jante mam, janasukriti narjuna. Four types of persons who come to him. Atoto, atarti, gani, arto, jignasu, etc. Chabaratarshaba. Four types come to Krishna. And they're all genuine in their reasons for coming to Krishna, but they're not genuine about their attraction to Krishna. So what happens, it is mentioned, I think, by Baladeva Vidabhushana, Arto Gani Atarti. So Arto means due to some distress, and Atarti means wanting some material remuneration. And in the middle of that, the word Jignasu comes. So I think Baladeva Vidabhushana mentions that the reason this word Jignasu comes in the middle is that unless those individuals who are coming out of distress or wanting some material remuneration become inquisitive, then there is every chance they'll leave Krishna consciousness. Again, inquisitive about what? We're always inquisitive. Every living entity, relationship practically means questions and answers. Practically, relationship means questions and answers, right? How are you? I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. What did you do today? Oh, really? Why did that happen? Oh, I can't believe she did that. Why do you think she... like that. So then that's what relationship generally means, questions and answers. So what type of questions are we asking? We're supposed to be asking questions about the tattva, jivasya tattva jignasa. We're supposed to be inquisitive about that. Jignasu shreya uttama, inquisitive about our highest welfare and Krishna consciousness. So then what are the type of questions that we're asked either externally to Krishna or within ourselves, that can easily point out where our attraction is in Krishna consciousness. And wherever our attraction is, that's where attention will flow, genuinely. And then the rest of the activities that we may be doing will be just externally done, superficially, without any heart. Just like Queen Kunti says, that those who are captured by wealth and aristocratic birth, education, and beauty, and they're intoxicated by those things, although they don't like to think that they're intoxicated by those things, then they will not be able to chant the holy name genuinely. Srila Prabhupada comments that the chanting of Hare Krishna should be like a child calling out for their mother. That's a pretty profound statement, although we often say it's hard to realize. A child calling out from the mother. However, if one will be taking shelter of other things, thinking them to be outside of Krishna, then one will not be able to do so genuinely. So that word is being mentioned here also. The word anatta, I think, is being used here. Anatta means, it is here in context, it's translated as bereft of a guardian, and sanatta meaning with a guardian. Srila Prabhupada Maharaj always likes to tell a story when he was in Vrindavan. I think he was in Vrindavan, and he saw a man carrying a dog. Was it in Vrindavan? I think it was in Vrindavan. He always tells a story. Whenever this word comes up, he always tells a story. I've heard it for so many years, at least 3-4 times. And he was in Vrindavan, and there was one dog there. You know, there's one dog who has shelter, Sanata. And there's always a bunch of street dogs in India. They didn't have any shelter. So then the street dogs came and saw the little dog. I think it was a poodle or something. And they all started, because that's the nature of a dog. They can't help themselves, you know. Can't blame them. And they started looking at the small dog like that. And then the master who was holding the small dog shows a stick, you know. And then all the other dogs, they go running off. And I think Maharaj usually makes a little joke there. You know, and the small dog like kind of wigs his tail or something. You know, I got shelter. In other words, I'm protected. And therefore, feeling shelter, I'm able to easily concentrate on the purpose of my life. If one is not feeling shelter, then the tendency, this bahu shaka hi anantascha thing takes place because of not feeling shelter. When you don't feel any shelter, one is always thinking how to make his own arrangements, how I'm going to protect myself, how I'm going to maintain myself, how I'm going to provide for myself or for my loved ones. All of that consciousness is due to a lack of feeling shelter, or in other words, anatta, being bereft of a guardian. So generally the conditioned souls not able to see Krishna. Krishna means nityo nityanam chetana chetananam eko bahunan yovadadati kamam. He's the one eternal living entity who's maintaining all the eternal living entities. Just like Prabhupada would say, the elephant is eating tons of food per day. You never hear him having meetings about economics and all these things, how to maintain. He is attracted. his attraction is genuine, because I'm stool-like, so it's a genuine attraction. So then, all the animals, they're being provided for. You never see them having big, big meetings, how we're going to provide, how we're going to maintain, all these things. But they're being maintained quite easily. Generally, that logic is way too simple for conditioned soul. Because we're human beings, right? We need to form societies, you know, and United Nations and all these things for how we're going to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. And it's a very sad affair. I'm sure if the animals had enough consciousness, they'll feel for us very bad. Oh, look how hard this Prabhu is working for sex life. You know, the monkey will be thinking like that. But when I want sex life, I just walk over and get my sex life and finish. And within 5 minutes, everything is done. This fellow has to work 12 hours a day for months and months together just for his 5 minutes of enjoyment. How horrible. And then he thinks this is human form of life. So why does that take place? Because a conditioned soul, particularly in the human form of life, he does not feel the shelter of Krishna. You see that the animals are also not worried about maintaining, but they also don't feel the shelter of Krishna. They have too much ignorance. In the human form of life, we have evolved consciousness in this form of life because this form of life is meant for developing God consciousness. But when we don't feel the shelter of Krishna, then we feel that we have to make unlimited other types of arrangements for maintaining ourselves, for providing for ourselves or our loved ones, etc. And that consumes all the consciousness. So even a person, a devotee, for example, may be chanting, but unless he has faith in the shelter of Krishna, then his chanting, during the chanting period, he plans out his day, he, she plans out the day, he, she thinks how many hours I have to work so I can get this much money, so I can save this much for my kids' college education, and I have this much for social engagement, I have this. Usually the giving 50% doesn't come into the picture, usually. That doesn't usually make it on the list of things to check off. Anyway, in this way, his whole consciousness is consumed. Why? Simply because he does not feel the shelter of Krishna. He is anatta. Even though he's chanting Hare Krishna, even he may be having bona fide spiritual master also, even he may be having the shelter of devotees, etc., because he does not feel that shelter of Krishna, so he becomes bahushaka hi anantashcha. How will I maintain? How will I maintain? So this is what's happening to Paranjana. He is anatta. He is anatta. He is not feeling the shelter of Krishna. So he's thinking, when I'm gone, who will take care of the wife? Who will take care of the children? She will be so burdened by these things. Just as I was burdened by these things, she will also be so much burdened by these things. And that's what's taking up his consciousness at the time of death. And so it's a very scary situation. One appreciation I was having recently and hearing these past time, a Paranjana, is that death has this ability to level off the playing field. If you will be recalling, Paranjana lived a pious life of sense gratification. I mean, he went astray for a little bit, but he got back on track. And he was living a pious life of sense gratification, pravritti marg, which is supposed to be ever so slowly spiritually progressive. And then this is in contrast to a very sinful life, which is not spiritually progressive, and which is horrible. You know, that such a sinful person quits his body like the cats and dogs. But what we're hearing about Paranjana is that death has this tendency to level off the playing field. In other words, it looks like pious and impious are different things, that piety is good and impiety is bad. Well, at the time of death, you see the situation is quite the same. In this regard, both persons are not feeling the shelter of Krishna. Both persons are thinking about family maintenance. Both persons are going to accept another material body, according to the laws of karma. So death has this power that we may be thinking, oh, I'm a devotee. Of course, there's always advantage to being a devotee, even if you're unaware of what the glorious thing that we're doing. It always can at least minimally generate a gata sukriti for some valiant try and some future birth. That's not considered very successful, but at least that, you know, power is there of even unknowingly doing devotional service. But generally the tendency is, because I'm a devotee, I am better than others who are not devotees. That is the general tendency, because I've chosen to give up my asura bhav, my demoniac mentality towards Krishna. At least I'm trying to progressively give that up. So the tendency is to feel oneself better than others, especially when we're in a stage of immaturity. And when you walk outside and you're interacting with people, you may do so cordially, but you're feeling that I'm in a better situation than they are. That's true in a lot of ways. But then at the time of death, death has this power to level off the playing field. And what happens at the time of death is that if we have not actually cultivated Christian consciousness where we're feeling the shelter of Krishna, then at the time of death, as Paranjana is finding himself encumbered, one, he's thinking of his wife, how he's going to maintain. He does not know that Krishna was maintaining all along, and that the only reason he was in that householder situation was for his purification. It was an arrangement of Krishna for purifying that soul. He is thinking, no, I am the provider, I am the maintainer, I am the enjoyer, I am the controller. Like that he is thinking. But actually, he does not know it is Krishna who was maintaining the whole time. And it was Krishna who made that arrangement for his purification. It was not, one is thinking, oh, I have done this. Karta hamiti manyate, I am the doer. But no one is doing anything in this material world. It is Krishna, a super soul, who is making all arrangements for the jivas. Brahmayan sarvabhutani jantaru dani maya. It is Krishna who is doing everything. So for those in Krishna consciousness, they should be knowing that whatever arrangement they're finding themselves in, either in this ashram or that ashram, or a particular varna, that situation is being arranged by Krishna for his purification. But if he does not think in that way, and therefore becomes attached to his occupation, to his ashram, and does not move forward in his actual filling of the shelter of Krishna, then, as Prabhupada says here, certainly one will think of the wife, and that means he will certainly not return home back to Godhead. Certainly. So that's a pretty strong word, I think. And he will have to begin a new chapter of material existence. So we have to analyze how much we are filling the shelter of Krishna. Another indication of how much we'll be filling the shelter of Krishna is how much we are freed from fear. Because when you're not having shelter, that's when fear accosts the consciousness. That's when it happens. So this is what's happening. How will my wife be maintained? How will my kids be maintained? So why? Because I'm not sanata. I don't actually have the shelter or feel the shelter of Krishna. So the consciousness, fear is a very dangerous thing. So this is why death is such a dangerous time period, because the fearful situation created by death is so intense. Fear is always accosting us throughout our life. We have so many fears. If I'll get my prasadam, like sometimes if you're doing service. One thing, for example, when you have a prasadam serve-out service, one thing they will tell the boys to do is to save your plate of prasadam. Why? So you won't be afraid if the prasadam will get over before, especially if it's nice preparation. So this is like cheesecake, for example. So at first, you want to be very sincere, like Janava Devi, serve everyone, make sure everyone is satisfied, like that. But when you see all the pieces are getting going, then you look around the corner and say, how long the line is? And you see the line is stretching around the thing. Then you say, hold on. Put it aside. So that the consciousness could be free from fear. Will I get my prasadam? That's a very crude example to show how prominent fear is in the conditioned soul. Ahara nidra bhayam, maitu namcha. Four things conditioned souls are doing: eating, sleeping, fearing, and mating. So fearing is a very, it really sucks up the consciousness. So what happens at the time of death is the most fearful situation. So being the most fearful situation, that fear has an ability to snatch the consciousness away from any other type of absorption. So if one doesn't, so in our cultivation of Krishna consciousness, we have to see how much we are progressively becoming freed from fear. Of course, there's a healthy balance, a healthy, let's say, application of fear. One should be having healthy fear of being victimized by Maya. That is illustrated by Krishna's pastimes and also Prahlad Maharaj's praise like this in this way. But general quality of divine life is abhayam. That's the first quality that's mentioned. If we don't become fearless before the time of death, then there's every chance that that fear will suck our consciousness and transfer us to another material body. So therefore, how do we get free from fear? We have to cultivate, let's say, namashraya, shelter in the holy name of Krishna. shelter in Krishna. And unless we feel that shelter, then there's every chance fear will take us over. Being anatta, we will become fearful. And then our consciousness will be stolen away by those things and which we're attached to, which we're afraid of losing. And in the material body, we will have to accept. So these are some points here that I could understand. Does anyone want to ask anything or you want to comment on anything? Okay, good.
Hare Krishna. I was wondering, I was doing some reflection the other day and I was thinking that maybe the fear of dishonor or like, you know, the having like ill regard from your peers or whatever is more prominent than actually like undergoing physical injury. Usually when I was thinking of fear before, it was like fear of death or fear of like, you know, somebody jumping me while I'm out on book distribution and stuff like that. But lately I was wondering about that fear of dishonor.
Fear is a result of our particular attachment. So if you're attached to honor, then that will be something that will cause great fear. But if you weren't attached to how others are seeing you, that wouldn't be a source of fear. So it depends on the particular attachment and how strong the attachment is for that particular something. So if someone is very, very, very attached to their body, like let's say like a beauty model, and she's very attached to her beauty, then growing old and death is a very cause of great, great fear. More than other things. So it depends on the attachment.
Do animals have false ego?
Of course. Of course. One is thinking I'm a pig and therefore eating stool. Someone is thinking I'm an ant, therefore going for sugar. Someone's thinking I'm a tiger eating me. Every conditioned soul has a false ego in the material world. In the human form of life, you just get to see the varieties that it can take on. Usually in animal forms of life, they're so controlled by nature that they don't act outside of their nature. But in the human form of life, because we have this higher intelligence, you see a lot of, let's say, variety in the human form of life, of expressions of false ego.
Thank you.
Okay. Is anyone else?
I was just wondering, in regards to the point you were emphasizing, attachment at the time of death, in a family of devotees, I was just thinking how that can be detrimental, even though, because ideally attachment to devotees is desirable. So if one happens to be in a family of devotees, then that attachment to them can still be a hindrance. But on one hand also, it's maybe helpful that they're attached to, people are devotees.
Thank you for bringing it. I meant to mention that point. I forgot to mention that point. And the attachment to the, like Queen Kunti is praying. There's a dilemma. Krishna's about to leave Hastinapur and go to Dwarka. So she has family in Hastinapur and family attachments in Dwarka, the Vrishnis and the Yadus. So if Krishna leaves one and goes to the other, or he stays here and doesn't go there, either way, it's a dilemma. So it's causing a tug of war in the heart. So she was feeling very much, let's say, distraught by this. So she prays to Krishna, please sever my attachment to the Vrishnis and the Yadus. You know, and as discussed in the purport, the attachment means the whatever residual material aspect of attachments are there, please let that be destroyed and let my consciousness go to you. Of course, to be attached to pure devotees is proper. So provided that it's not being impinged by material attachment, you know, attachment based on the material idea of the person. She was asking for that to be removed and for the genuine attachment to a devotee of Krishna be, let's say, established. So in regards to devotee families, if we're not on the pure devotional platform yet, we're moving progressively there, but we're not there, then it's always important to remember what is our duty to the family members. This is, you know, love can never be separate from duty. You know, you can't have love without being dutiful. So we have to understand, it should be understood, what is my duty in relationship to this particular living entity and whom I'm relating to in a particular sort of way. So the mother has a particular duty to the child, like we were hearing yesterday. And the example that was cited was, one of the examples was Shachi Devi. So she was very attached to her son, naturally. That is an internal relationship anyway, but in principle, she was attached to the son. So Mahaprabhu said, he told, he was prepared to give up his sannyas for his mother. But as she felt it her duty, no, because then so much dishonor will come to you and I'll be the source of that. Therefore, you should continue your sannyas and, you know, you shouldn't stay at the house. But she gave a request, can you please stay in Puri? And that way we can get some news of you, etc. So then her, let's say a parent, material attachment did not impede her giving the proper direction to her son, that you go and continue your sannyas so ill repute should not come to you. So in the case of family members, when we're trying to, we're sadhakas, which means we're not perfected devotees, then we have to always consider in terms of our duty to our dependents, and also dependents should consider what is their duty to their parents. And the loving relationship has to be established on that platform. Otherwise, the selfish predilection will take over, and you'll have parents who keep their, you know, or clip their wings of their kids or want to live out their dreams to their kids. That happens all the time. Or, and then what happens with the kids is that they don't respect their parents when they get in the older stage. They don't have proper regard. And this is all due to negligence of duty, generally. So amongst devotees who are not perfected souls, we have to consider in that way also, what is my duty to this individual, living entity?
Okay.
Anything else?